This is Open Minds Radio. Here again, your host, UFO paranormal researcher and journalist, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome to Open Minds Radio, your UFO news authority. This is Alejandro Rojas, and you are listening to our Halloween special. That's my evil laugh. And why are evil people laughing so much? I don't think, you know, they may be laughing on the outside, but I know deep down they're crying. They don't want to be evil. It's just a cry for help. But the Halloween show is really exciting. If you're a scared person, if you're scared of vampires and werewolves and Sasquatch and extraterrestrials, then quit being a sissy, because this is paranormal investigation. And, you know, we got to be strong. We got to be resolute. Such as the two paranormal investigators that we're going to be talking to today. Later on in the show, we're going to have Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She is a leading expert on the paranormal and supernatural. She's written more than 40 books, 9 of those being encyclopedias, including her last one, her latest, which just came out recently, on vampires and werewolves. So, really cool. If you're a nuts and bolts UFO person, don't, you know, stop listening. You're going to like this because we're going to be talking about some of her investigations into UFOs, abductions, things like that, and how they relate to ghosts. And what's really cool with Rosemary is she's made some really, I think, incredible discoveries in this arena that you're going to be interested in. I don't know if she's even shared them yet. I know she's writing a book on some of this, but hasn't yet. So this is going to be exciting. Also, to further give you evidence and satisfy your right brain, we are going to start off with Jason Cordova, who we've had before, my cousin from Denver, and he started the Crypto Science Society, an organization at the Metro State College of Denver campus. And they do some paranormal investigation out there. Their student center is actually a very old brewery that's said to be haunted. And we're going to focus on an investigation that they did at this brewery and bring Jason on to tell us about that. And then we're going to play some EVPs, some evidence, some really strange stuff. These are EVP is electro voice phenomena or electronic voice phenomena. And that's when you go to a haunted place and you take a recording device, either a tape player or a digital player, and sometimes when you play these devices back, you hear voices that you didn't hear in the first place. And these are literally, you know, like people talking that weren't there. Very strange stuff. So let's go ahead and bring Jason on. Jason, are you there?
I am here. How are you?
Excellent. Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Good. It's good to be good.
Good to be good. Well, let's two pieces of news with the Crypto Society before we get into it. First of all, you said you were working on, I know now you're an alumnus, so you're working on getting other universities and colleges and paranormal groups to join your group, and you have a new group that is joining your network. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, and I'm going on their radio show this Friday.
Awesome.
The UNO, University of Nebraska, UFO study group. They host their local chapter at MUFON, and we've been talking, and he never even knew the Crypto Science Society existed, and he sure wished he had when he started it. We started around the same time, and we, his name, John Powers is the name of the gentleman who runs that group.
Cool.
And, we've chatted, and he's interested in at least joining the network. We're looking at doing two basic things, either encouraging students to start their own chapters of Crypto Science Society. You know, the hard work's already been done. Use our model. Go ahead and start your own chapter. Or, if you already got your own, go ahead and join the network as an affiliate organization. As long as you fill three basic criteria, one, that you're affiliated with a college or university, two, have some sort of educational program to educate the public, and that you do your own investigations and research.
Cool, I know.
And
Was that all three?
Yeah, that's all three.
They have Jack Kasher there. They're a physicist, professor of physics out there who, I think he's the Nebraska State Director for MUFON out there.
Yep.
Also, you have, if you could real quickly tell me about this event that you guys do, which is really cool, that's coming up, your mystery tour.
The Haunted History Tour.
Haunted History Tour.
The Haunted History Tour,
I remember
it rhymed with
Magical Mystery Tour.
Yes, it's full of magic and mystery, and basically it is a guided walking tour through the Orrery campus. You know, if the campus used to be a mining town, and it was very diverse, you know, had a very diverse population, and every year we team up with the History Club and the Historians Honor Society to do a historical walking tour, present the history of the campus, and some of the more ghoulish, fun kind of Halloween type of stories, as well as present evidence from our own paranormal investigations that we've done at various sites throughout the campus.
That's really cool. And, of course, one of the most haunted sites on the campus is the Tivoli. So why don't you set up the investigation, when it happened, and who was involved that produce these EVPs that we're going to be listening to?
Well, over the years, we've done a couple investigations as well as training in there. But the most valuable stuff, really, the most valuable data that we've uncovered was from that very first investigation that we teamed up with the Para FPI. They're a local professional organization that have done paranormal investigations throughout the state. And we teamed up with them to help us out with some techniques and equipment. And basically what we did was there's an area in the Tivoli that's down in sort of the bowels of the building. As I think we mentioned earlier, the Tivoli used to be a brewery, and this area that we come to call the catacombs now is where they used to store the beer. There's also an area that has had incarnations as a nightclub and a speakeasy, and now we kind of double it for some of our meetings sometimes. Anyway, the catacombs area where they used to store the beer was set up to be a sort of an artificial cave, and the general public is not allowed to go in there. We get special permission to go in there, set up a remote station. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with what a remote station is, so rather than running around with all of your equipment, you just set it up and leave it alone. What we did was we had a video camera, battery-powered video camera, a motion-sensing camera trap, a audio recorder, and I believe a temperature sensor. I'll have to go back and check, but that's the basic remote station. We set it up, locked it up, and left it alone.
Yeah, so these rooms were locked. Nobody's in there.
Right, and we verified that nobody was going in or out. You know, you have positive control of the whole space. And again, this is an area where the general public is not allowed to go anyway, so it would be very difficult for somebody to just wander in there.
And there's supposed to be a little girl possibly haunting that area.
Right. There's been a number of reports of a little girl who is seen, actually has been seen running around at night. The late night workers describe seeing just this little girl playing in the rooms when they go to clean it. They close the door, turn around, and she's gone. They hear laughing and a little pitter-patter as she's running down the halls. And we've had some psychic mediums join us on investigations as well, and they've actually described communicating with her.
Wow.
The name Polly or Molly was originally pulled from this psychic medium who we had in there, one of the first investigations. And what was most interesting was that this was this investigation was preparation for our very first haunted history tour, because we had just started as an organization. We didn't have all that much information on the campus as far as hauntings, And while we were doing our paranormal investigations, the History Club and the Honor Society were digging up their own historical research independently. So separate researchers independently doing research and ended up corroborating each other later on.
So as even about this little girl?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We discovered the founder of the brewery was a gentleman by the name of Moritz Ziggy, and his daughter was named Margaret, but she went by the name Molly.
Oh, wow.
And that was a very obscure piece of information that was not general knowledge at all.
Wow, very interesting. And the reason I bring up the little girl is because the first EVP we're going to listen to here is a moan that sounds like a little girl. So let's go ahead and play that now. Ooh, well, maybe one more time. Yeah, definitely. Now, do you remember where that microphone was?
Yes, actually, it was locked up in the catacomb area.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Siggy's Cabaret, which is kind of the lecture hall now, which used to be the speakeasy and the nightclub. And then directly adjacent to it, there's the catacomb area, which they use it for storage and a very secluded off-the-side area was where we had it set up.
So no one was around there.
Right, with the camera and the motion sensor and the audio recorder right in the general vicinity. What is really interesting about that piece is that the camera experienced battery drain. What battery drain is, obviously, is you have a fully charged battery and it drains out inexplicably. This is what happened here. The camera shut off, and during that time frame while the camera was off, the audio recorder picked up these anomalous sounds, everything from metal banging, things shuffling around, whispers, to that little, what sounds like a little girl sighing.
Wow. Yeah, very cool, very interesting EVP, that one. That one's exciting. But let's listen to some more. Another one is this voice that says, "We're in here," and let's play it first, and then I'll ask you more about it. But listen for this, because it's a little difficult to hear, but they say, it sounds like, "We're in here," a whisper. So go ahead and play that one. Yeah, maybe do that one more time, too. So that one's a little difficult to hear. Hopefully you have your headphones on. If not, you know, maybe listen to the show again later with your headphones and you'll hear it. But it sounds like a male voice saying, "We're in here." So do you remember the situation behind that microphone as well?
It was the same situation.
Uh-huh.
And there's another entity that has been detected, what's interpreted as kind of a crotchety old man. The medium's described that he's a kind of a guy that just lingers there and doesn't really like to socialize.
Hmm.
It's possible that could be that could be him, or it could be any number of things. Could be a residual. That area, that part of the building has, you know, had a lot of activity over the years, and anywhere from somebody drowning in a flood to anybody who had attended some kind of event at the nightclub when it was a nightclub.
Well, like you said, it was a cabaret, and it was also, there was like a little holding area there nearby, right?
Nearby, yes, when the bar was active on the other side. It was actually on the other side of the cabaret area. So this has the cabaret area, and then on the other side, completely opposite, it was a little holding area that they would take the unruly patrons and stick them there as kind of like almost like a detox until they settled down.
Or the cops could come and drag them off, huh?
Yep.
Now, that one, if I remember correctly, so that one was in a secluded area. So that one wasn't in response to investigator asking questions or anything.
Correct.
Okay. Because I know sometimes that happens, and I thought maybe that was the case with this one where an investigator had actually asked a question and got this response.
No. And actually, I believe it should say, are you playing them from the website?
No, I downloaded them and we're playing them, yeah.
Okay. There's a couple of them that actually have where they were taken. For example, EVP number 8, it was taken, there's some anomalous whispering in the boiler room service hallway. That's what you're thinking of in that area where the holding area is. So that's EVP number 8.
Gotcha. EVP number 8. And all of you can go to, you can Google Crypto Science Society. You can Google Denver Paranormal Science, because I used to be the Denver Paranormal Science Examiner, and I wrote a story that has all these EVPs and videos. You can also go to YouTube and look up Tivoli Ghost or Tivoli Haunted, and you'll see a video I put together. And there's a few videos of Jason out there being interviewed about the Tivoli, because you're kind of like the haunted Tivoli authority anymore, huh?
Yep, it's becoming that way. There was actually some CU students did a documentary called The Hauntings of Auraria, and that's all over YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's a really good one.
Well, there is...
But I don't think...
Go ahead.
They don't actually play the EVPs in that one, but you can get it off of the website, yes.
Yep.
And I should use this opportunity to plug the Crypto Science Society has a new website.
Oh.
Which you can link to the old one from, but you can't link to the new one from the old one.
Yeah. Okay. But and Crypto Science Society being three words. But I've got one more EVP, and this one's my favorite because it seems to be the most clear. It's kind of creepy, and it's just kind of strange, and that's the come-in one. And, again, let's play the EVP. What I've got here is we'll play the EVP. This one's a little difficult because you hear people talking and mulling about, and then you hear this come in. And so we'll play that. But I also separated it and put it into an audio file where I play that just that piece over and over again so you can hear it more clear. So we'll play both those pieces now, and then we'll talk about them. I like playing it over and over because it's just this voice that doesn't sound, you know, like a modern day person saying, come in. It's this, come in. You know, it's a kind of creepy, ghosty come in sound.
In an old timey way.
Right, in an old timey way.
And the investigator, I believe it was Steve Hart, one of the para FBI members, said that he saw a shadow in the doorway on the inner catacomb area when they collected that particular piece of recording.
Well, and speaking of old-timey, one of them, and I don't even see it on the website because I think this is a great one too, and is one of the EVPs you captured sounded like some old-timey music.
Mm-hmm. What we think that actually may have been spillover from an event that was going on in the turn hall.
I disagree.
And that's why it wasn't put up.
Put it up.
All right. I will relay that information.
What was the event going on?
It was, honestly, I don't remember what the event was, but it was, there had been some music and some horns playing, it was specifically, and the way we filtered it out was actually when we did the analyzation, was that these anomalous recordings, when we analyze them, don't have echoes, which doesn't happen in the physical universe, which is why it was most compelling, and that's why we made the decision to separate the ones that were a little bit weird, but maybe a little bit questionable, and the ones that were definitively anomalous. So oh, being
that's
one,
very interesting. They didn't have echoes.
None of the echoes, or none of the sounds have echoes.
Wow.
The anomalous sounds have
right.
echoes.
Oh, cool. But the old-timey one I like because it sounded like this piano, like a da-da-da-da. Kind of
yeah.
old-time, real old-timey kind of weird stuff.
Right.
I can just
and
imagine.
Maybe we could put it up as a side-by-side comparison, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Data sharing and whatnot. Let some other people have their way with it, see what they come up with.
Yeah, see what they think. Well, cool. These are exciting EVPs. And I know that Haunted History Tour that you do is a lot of fun because you get in character. I think I have a picture of you on my Facebook in character doing the tour. But the Auraria campus is so old, and it used to be a community, and lots of some of the old homes are still some of the college offices. I know on the campus, actually, this is a campus that's in the heart of downtown Denver, and there's three schools there. There's the Denver campus of University of Colorado. There's Metro State College and is it Colorado Community College, the other one?
Community College of Denver.
Oh, Community College of Denver. So there's tons of people on this campus, and you have kind of this preserved old Auraria town area with some great history, some deaths, some hauntings, lots of scary stuff, huh?
Right.
Well, not scary, but...
Well, it's really
scary for sissies, maybe.
The ideas of the wild, wild west, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a rough and tumble wild west town.
Right.
Everything from duels in the street to kids ice skating on it. You know, they used to flood the street right there on 9th Street. That's what we're talking about, is the historical 9th Street Park area. And they used to flood that and ice skate on it, make a little ice skating rink.
Wow. In fact, you know, we got a couple minutes. Maybe you could tell us. I know one of the more exciting stories is as one of the churches, there's several churches on the grounds, these old churches which were preserved, and in one of them there was like a priest who was murdered?
Yes, it was pretty dramatic, a dramatic story. He was giving communion, and an anarchist assassinated him.
Mm-hmm.
He fled, was captured, and it was found out that he was part of a whole anarchist group that was after they were specifically tasked with assassinating priests throughout
wow.
the area, and they were all executed. And I believe they were the last group of people who were executed by hanging in the state of Colorado.
Really?
Yes, officially by governmental execution standards.
Do you know where they were hung?
Probably Civic Center Park.
Oh, wow, right downtown. That's where I had my first Colorado UFO briefing.
Yes, which actually we've uncovered some interesting stuff about the city and county building.
Really?
Some interesting hauntings. There's a report of supposedly the hell mouth opened up to the point where the workers said they could smell the brimstone and the dead walked the halls. For
the hell mouth?
Yes.
What's that?
A gateway into hell.
Really? There's a report of, like, the Hellmouth opening.
Right. The workers reported smelling brimstone and seeing the dead walk the halls. Obviously,
wow.
They didn't hang around.
And then they saw the politicians crawling out of hell and taking their place in the government.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Oh, and of course, it's an awesome, it's a Mason building that's got a whole bunch of esoteric symbolism in the architecture. It's great. Love that kind of stuff. But aside from that, back to Auraria campus, we were talking about, what were we talking about over there?
Well, I think you had finished your story about the guys getting hung and stuff, and then the hell mouth open.
Right. Okay. We were talking about...
Hell broke loose, literally.
St. Elizabeth. St. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth. Father Leo being assassinated by the anarchist. Allegedly, there are a number of people who have reported seeing Father Leo as a full-body apparition in the sanctuary a number of times, usually late afternoon-ish. Unfortunately, we've been negotiating with the parish who is supposedly negotiating with the archdiocese to allow us to come in and do an investigation there. Obviously, some people are more keen on it than others.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that plays into politics, where it's actually a still remains a functioning Catholic church on the campus. The other two are desanctified and absorbed as the Auraria Campus Higher Education Center manages those buildings as lecture
mm-hmm.
halls now, while St. Elizabeth is still a functioning church.
Oh, both? I know St. Cajetan's, of course, we've had lots of events there. You host lots of events there. That's where I started having my Colorado briefing, one of the beautiful churches on campus there that I guess has been desanctified. What is the other one?
The other one is the Emmanuel Gallery.
Okay. That's
actually
a small building.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
And it was only a church briefly, and it was a synagogue as well. It was originally a synagogue, then it was a church, and then it was turned over to a private owner. And is now an art gallery.
Oh, cool. All right, so what day is your haunted history tour?
The 28th of October, Thursday.
Okay, Thursday, and that's free people to show up at this 9th Street area. Is that correct?
Right, it's the north end of 9th Street Park.
Uh-huh, and at what time?
And this happens every year, 7
right.
p.m. Usually aim for around sundown if you're unsure.
So 7 p.m. if you're in the Denver area or you're in Colorado and the surrounding states, it's free and it's fun and it's got an incredible history. We've only heard a fraction of what you shared during that history tour.
That's right.
And then you get to go where the EVPs were recorded. And there, like I said, there's a lot of EVPs. Like Jason said, you know, he's referring to EVP 8 earlier. We only played three, I think the three most clear and three fun ones, but go check out the website for more. Thanks for being on the show, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure.
And if I can plug the new website.
Okay.
It's metro.orgsync.com/org/cryptoscience society.
Those URLs are always too long.
I know. And you can get to the old website through that one.
Most people Google anyway, so you can Google Crypto Science Society.
Unfortunately, the new website doesn't come up in the Google.
Oh, no.
The old one. So go to the new website to look at all the new stuff coming up and events and what they're doing, and then check out the old content through the link on there.
Cool. All right, thanks. Okay, coming up next, we have Rosemary Ellen Guiley, but I did want to share a couple pieces of information. You probably noticed we skipped the news this time in order to talk about these EVPs and stuff like that. But as far as news, the big news that just happened recently is Zachariah Sitchin unfortunately passed. He passed on October 9th, but for some reason, we only just found out about it this week. And if you're unfamiliar with his work, he studied ancient Sumerian culture, and he feels he was able to translate the Sumerian writings more than anybody else. And in these writings, he found out about a planet that comes every so often called Nibiru, that there are these Anunnaki or possibly aliens on this planet that come and they interact with us. This is kind of what the Sumerian mythology was. They felt that this kind of concept that these aliens come and they kind of enslaved humanity in order for humanity to get the gold or for the aliens to harvest gold. An interesting mythology he feels that the Sumerians had. I say he feels because it is under dispute a bit. There's different translations. There wasn't when he got started, but now there's a lot of different translations of this Sumerian text. So, of course, those people are arguing about it. But he was very famous, wrote a lot of books about this. And, in fact, the movie Fourth Kind, highlighted his work. You know how on Fourth Kind that the aliens were supposedly speaking in ancient Sumerian and they used this book to research all of this stuff. That was Sitchin's stuff, although they didn't give him credit for that. But he was a very important person in this whole ancient astronauts movement. And so it's unfortunate he passed because he was very popular and, you know, people loved to hear from him. And he did a lot of talks. And unfortunately, I never got to see him talk. And I always hoped to, and I always figured I would. But unfortunately, that did not happen. So rest in peace, Mr. Sitchin. And we wish for you the best. And thank you for all that you did. Also, of course, I want to remind you, UFOCongress.com, go sign up for the Congress. If you didn't hear me last week, we have the Honorable Paul Hellyer now signed up, the ex-Minister of Defense for Canada, and he's going to be there to actually talk with people and sell his books, which is kind of nice because he's never really done that and spent time with people. So you're going to be able to get to meet and talk with him, an absolutely wonderful person. Speaking of absolutely wonderful people, we have Rosemary Ellen Guiley on the line. She is so very, very busy this time of year, traveling all over the country, doing lectures and talks on ghosts and everything, and she's still writing books. Rosemary, are you there?
I am, Alejandro. It's just a real pleasure to be with you today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and it's wonderful to have you on today. I know you're extremely busy.
Well, this is the time of year for people in the paranormal.
Yep.
You know, it really goes on 365 days a year. Everybody's attention is focused right around Halloween.
Right. Yeah, I know you keep very busy pretty much all year round, let alone this time of year. And you keep yourself busy with all of these books that you write.
I've always got multiple projects going. I love doing research in this field, and I try and do as much original field research and investigation as I can. So I'm out in the field quite a bit. I work with a variety of groups around the country, actually. And I go to conferences. I'm networking all the time. I have a pretty heavy speaking schedule myself. So whatever you're keeping busy, and I wish I had an army of doppelgangers.
Yeah, that'd be nice. You haven't figured out how to do that yet, huh?
Not yet, but I'm working on it.
Well, if there's anybody, you'll be the first one to figure it out, and let me know when you do, too.
I think a lot of us would like to have a few.
Yeah. I guess to start off with, what was it that got you involved with paranormal research, and how long ago was that?
Well, probably about the time I could pick up a crayon, which is about when I started writing.
Wow.
Because when I was little, I had some unusual experiences, some psychic experiences. And I think most children do. Children are very open to the paranormal. And we've probably all had at least one experience. These sorts of things begin to fade into the background as we get older. But for me, they were very much in the forefront of my life. At a very young age, I became fascinated by horror, the paranormal, science fiction, fantasy, and other members of my family had recurring experiences too, my mother in particular and my sister. So even though I would not describe myself by any means as like a psychic wonder kid, you know, like the sixth sense boy, I still had experiences that made a profound impression on me. And as I got older, I realized that not everybody has these experiences. You know, when you're a kid, you think everybody sees the world the same way that you do. And the paranormal is definitely not a level playing field. So that got my curiosity going. Why do some of us have regular experiences, or I should say frequent experiences with the unseen, and other people don't seem to? And why do the skeptics say it's all in our heads? That just didn't make any sense to me because my experiences were real. I knew they were real. And other people that I talked to over time also had genuine experiences. A study of our mythology and folklore shows us that people have been having experiences since we came on this planet. So that's really what launched me into what became my lifelong pursuit of the unseen. And as a result, I wanted to look at everything. I didn't want to look at just one slice of the pie. And that proved to be a very valuable direction to go in, because it soon became apparent to me that everything's interconnected.
Right.
And so that's the central focus of my work, is looking for those interconnections to explain the big picture.
One thing that really kind of amuses me in this field is that, you know, you look at the whole pie like you're talking about, but it is interesting that there are some people that will focus on one sort of phenomena or another, and they're really closed-minded towards other types of phenomena. It's kind of a weird thing that happens in this field, you know. Even, let's say, Bigfoot. There are a lot of Bigfoot researchers. Of course, Bigfoot is difficult. A lot of people don't believe in that. Certainly, I think we'd say less than extraterrestrials. And so to a lot of people, when you say you're a Bigfoot researcher, it sounds like you're kind of out there anyway. And then when you say, oh, but, you know, all this other stuff is bunk and isn't real, it's an interesting dynamic.
Well, it is, Alejandro, and I've seen a very puzzling disconnect between the paranormal community and the ufology community.
Yeah.
You would think that these two communities would be having regular dialogue with each other, but they don't. Ufologists tend to focus on the ET experience and contact experiences and those parameters. And the paranormal people off looking for ghosts and poltergeists and demons and things like that. But when we get into these haunted areas, and actually I've started referring to my research as interdimensional entity contact research rather than calling it even paranormal, because we find multiple kinds of phenomena just leading into each other. You go into some of these heavily haunted areas and you've got mysterious lights in the sky, people having contact experiences, mysterious creatures, ghost and poltergeist phenomena, men in black, demonic-looking entities, everything blended together. So you have to look at the whole big picture. And people who have ET contact experiences also usually have a host of other experiences that fall more into the paranormal area. So
right.
I really encourage people to try and be as well-versed as possible, at least to have some background knowledge of what's going on in these other fields. As you know, there's just so much coming out all the time, it gets difficult to keep current in a lot of these areas. But we really need to be as diversified as possible.
And what did you call it? Interdimensional?
Interdimensional entity contact. And I've used those terms because I think that what we're dealing with are entities from other dimensions, parallel dimensions. Sometimes we don't even know what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
It may be hard to determine whether something, for example, an ET or demonic or fairy or unknown origins, you know, John Keel kind of lumped them all as ultra-terrestrials from other dimensions. So clearly we're dealing with entities,
right.
But sometimes we don't know exactly what they are.
See, I love that term. That's a great term, and I think it's more accurate because our terminology really needs to change, especially as science in these fields. A lot of people don't know that there are scientists interested in these fields, and they are making some headway, at least slowly, because they have to work independently. And, you know, what you're talking about, interdimensionality and the entities that we may be interacting with, there are scientists out there who are discussing these type of things in a serious manner.
And I'm so glad to see that, too. And yes, we need to have serious scientific inquiry. It seems to be up to the layperson, interested individuals such as myself, who are not in the hard sciences, to pursue a lot of this firsthand research. But there are other scientists who are willing to get out there and consider the bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
One of the persons that I've really enjoyed working with, and I collaborate with a lot of people in this field, is Phil Imbrogno, who's well-known in ufology, but he's also a scientist. And we've done a couple of books together where he really brings in the hard science to explain what's going on. What does quantum physics have to say about our entity contact experiences? And I think we're going to see more and more of this as we develop our ideas about science, and also we've got such improved technology now for exploring the paranormal. It's going to give us better evidence.
Yeah, it seems like, especially with quantum physics, and quantum physicists, theoretical physicists, start to get into all of this, because quantum physics begins to allow this phenomena to be possible, where other scientific laws, physical laws that are conventional, don't understand or don't fit the paradigm. Are you finding that?
Absolutely. And to me, the idea of parallel dimensions makes so much sense when you consider how our experiences take place and why no hard evidence, or I should probably say very little hard evidence, if any, is left behind. And I think this is one of the things that confronts the Bigfoot community, the people who are convinced that Bigfoot is an Earth-based species that just hasn't been discovered and captured yet. To me, it makes more sense that these entities come and go through openings between dimensions. And if we have multiple dimensions that are very close to us, close to our own, we don't even need to go outside of our own universe, really, to have quite a few experiences with different kinds of entities who really don't belong originally in our own.
Right. And, there's scientific research that demonstrates some of this. I mean, a big one that comes to mind is the Skinwalker Ranch, where it seems like there was some sort of interdimensional back and forth happening. And the strangest phenomena happening and the strangest creatures never documented before kind of coming through and being witnessed by people.
It's a terrific case. And the book that George Knapp and Colm Kelleher wrote, Hunt for the Skinwalker, will actually put chills up and down your spine. Since that book has come out and other researchers have been investigating other hot zones, I've encountered some skinwalker-like places on the East Coast.
Wow.
That are every bit as good and creepy as that place. And a couple of those are going to be featured in one of my books coming out next year on multidimensional portals that Phil and I did together, where we went out looking in these hot zone areas for what's out there and how do we define these hot zones and what can we predict about them. I think they're all over the place, Alejandro,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the times we don't even know it. We don't know where to look. It's around that bend in space and time that most of us don't see past. But then a lot of them are in more rural areas where everyday people don't have a lot of access.
Right. And I think, why I like to go there and to discuss that and to why I think all of that is really important is because even if you are of one of these singular disciplines, like a UFO researcher, a lot of times if you stick to nuts and bolts and, things will happen in your investigation that are difficult to explain and so preposterous, perhaps, that people, researchers, throw them out because they just can't accept it because it's so crazy. But we're finding that, with what you're talking about with these interdimensional, interactions, that practically anything is possible. And as I'm sure you would agree, that truth is much, much, much stranger than fiction.
It certainly is. And over the years, I've been working in the paranormal full time now since the early 1980s. And my horizons have certainly expanded. I've had to expand them just based on the evidence I've found. And we can't cherry pick the paranormal. We can't believe in one thing and not another and just reject something out of hand because maybe it stretches our boggle point too much. There's always the danger of dealing with imagination and confabulation and, you know, things like that. But as I mentioned earlier, clearly the record of our history shows that human beings have been having encounters with unknown entities from our very beginnings, and we've had different explanations and different labels from them for them, but our experiences have actually remained fairly consistent. So I've taken a lot more on board, and I'm very upfront about my own beliefs. I've been a believer from the time I was little because of my own experiences. I didn't need somebody to tell me whether or not the paranormal was real or give me permission to believe in it. I don't need science to tell me that it's there because I know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I've had to be objective as a researcher to look for natural explanations first. We've simply got to do that in order to come up with the really good evidence. And you're still left with amazing things that defy explanation all across the board, all kinds of experiences. I'm always interviewing people about their experiences. I've found that when you start asking a lot of questions, you do get into this big picture territory.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I started researching shadow people about 5 or so years ago, on the surface, it looks like a paranormal experience, threatening dark figures who come into your bedroom at night. They have kind of a demonic look, a demonic attitude, and a lot of people think they're demons, but I don't think they are. By asking questions of hundreds of experiencers, I found out I just kind of stumbled on a big ET connection, that a lot of the experiencers were also ET experiencers. So that led me in a whole different direction of my research. These are the sorts of things that paranormal investigators, I'm using that term to just cover the broad map of everybody
right.
in this, we've got to ask questions that will take us in new directions, and we've got to be willing to go there. That's what science does. You know, you start with a hypothesis, and if the evidence supports the hypothesis, you have to come up with something else. You can't hammer square pegs into round holes. And unfortunately, we find researchers who do that. They have predisposed ideas of what they want to find, and they go out and fit the data to their ideas.
Right, and that's what good science is supposed to do, what you're talking about, because unfortunately, even with conventional science, you know, that sometimes they're not good scientists. For instance, you know, some animal doing something strange that the scientist can't imagine why it's doing that and throwing out that happens instead of studying why the animals do this. I mean, unfortunately, in lots of disciplines, there's some bad science, and especially in ours, because, like you said, and I love that term, you know, people run into this boggle point where, and some people are uncomfortable with being boggled.
Very true. You know, we all have our comfort zones, and, you know, it's unsettling to find something out that disturbs your worldview. I think this is one of the problems, for example, plaguing the research into survival after death. What happens after we die is one of the biggest questions that human beings have been asking. And yet it's kind of like, well, we want to know, but we don't really want to know.
Yeah.
And this is another topic that I've been involved in for some years. And I just finished a book with George Norrie that will be out next year that looks at this question and also our high-tech ability to get evidence for survival. And what are the implications of that? Well, you know, you bring religion into a lot of these things, which you do with afterlife beliefs, and the evidence may not support a lot of, ultimately, I mean, we don't know yet because we haven't gotten conclusive proof. We've got lots of evidence. But maybe our religious beliefs are not going to be supported by what we really find.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, you know, explosive issues. It's, you know, in ufology, we've talked about the proverbial UFO on the White House lawn sort of thing and the implications of that. We believe in ETs, or a lot of people do, but how would we react if we really came face-to-face with one irrefutably?
Right. Yeah, that's a meditation I try to do on a regular basis to prepare myself or to figure myself out, because when I started doing that, I ran into another issue people run across is, of course, being fearful. At what
being what?
Fearful. Because, of course, a lot of researchers...
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Not only
absolutely.
Are they too boggled by something, they're too afraid of something.
Well, it is. It's the unknown, and it falls outside the known laws of our reality. You start getting into things that pop in and out unpredictably. They're not solid like everything around you. They're outside of space and time. And frequently they can see you and you can't see them. It gets to be very scary for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Have you ran across, I would imagine you have, ran across times where you are fearful. Can you explain maybe one of those times?
I certainly have had some moments where I did feel frightened, and I have even left a few scenes of investigations because I felt it was the prudent thing to do.
Hmm.
You know, when things get to be very intense and negative and people start feeling ill and you're obviously in the presence of something very powerful and very negative. Sometimes it's you have to know when to fold them and when to hold them.
Mm-hmm.
I've never screaming from a place, however. but I, in pursuit of my things on the more paranormal side, which would be negative hauntings, demonic entities, beings that we call the jinn, who can be very nasty toward people, much like demons can. Yes, there have been times when I've been investigating haunted places, and you come up against something that makes itself known to you very clearly in an intense and negative way. And you know that it can have the upper hand very easily. Some of them are quite malevolent. It is possible that for them to affect your health.
Hmm.
I've seen many people become psychologically destabilized by doing some of their investigations. If you know, you've got to be very well grounded to undertake a lot of serious work in the paranormal, and it can be destabilizing. And I've had things, the worst thing that ever happened to me physically was I got cut once.
Wow.
I can't, you know, people sometimes get these thin, bloody little razor cuts and
right.
Negative demonic hauntings, and I got one of those once. I've had negative entities literally drain a lot of my energy to the point where I felt sick. And you have to be very careful and to avoid, long-term effects. I don't want to take things home. I
mm-hmm.
feel that if you're doing serious investigation in this field and you are regularly beaten and battered, so to speak, whether it's metaphorically or literally, something is wrong. We have natural barriers against these phenomena, and they should not be breached on a regular basis. Some people's boundaries tend to be a little thinner than others,
mm-hmm.
but there's nothing to be gained by having horrible dine-out stories, you know. And some people want those. They want to be drama kings and queens.
Yeah.
And that's effective in the paranormal.
But
it does happen.
Uh-huh.
So it's unavoidable from time to time.
Right. Now, on the same token, do you feel that, I kind of feel in our society, we do get a little too afraid of everything at times. Although, yeah, you have to know your boundaries. But we kind of have a society or a kind of a thought that it's actually different in traditional Native American thoughts, is that we're so separated from nature that we're just kind of this small little thing that is prey to a lot of different things. Whereas more of a Native American type of idea is that we're all part of everything, and to know the spirit world and to know your boundaries, but not necessarily feel as powerless as people often do.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, that we here in the modern industrialized West do not have a well-integrated worldview. And actually that goes way back to ancient times, even though ancient peoples were much closer to these invisible realms than we are today. But Aristotle was one of the first major influences to separate the physical world from what you would call the imaginal realm. And I don't mean imagination, like, you know, fabricated, but the imaginal realm, these other areas that are accessed in a different sensory way. I mean, he said, if you can't experience it through your five senses, it doesn't exist. And that's our experience defies that. We do have experiences that can't be, they have to come through the five senses. We may feel something, smell something, hear something, and even see something that isn't in our reality. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And, of course, in the so-called Enlightenment, where we had an increasing separation of the mind, body, and spirit, we've really got a very splintered way of understanding our reality, and it's much different in other cultures. In modern times, in other cultures, you find much different attitudes about the place of these other realms in the context of what we would call ordinary reality.
That's what I think is exciting. I mean, a big reason I like to work in this field is to try to not only experience or document or interface with the other realms, but to also then bring that to the public like you're doing, to let people have a better, I think, idea of their reality.
It is important to educate people, and we have kind of a weird way of approaching it in our media, because, you know, everybody likes to be entertained and scared, and so we've got the fear factor going on films and television, which gives us a very skewed view of what's out there. The general public obviously has a huge appetite and thirst for experience and knowledge in this area, just gauging from the increase in paranormal themed shows, programs, documentaries, films, and the phenomenon that we have now, the so-called reality television shows, which are hugely popular. There's really very little reality in them because they're scripted and faked and fabricated.
Right. Even when they say they're based off of real stories, or even if they falsely claim that they are true stories, they're not. They're usually so off base.
Well, they are, and a lot of it is because it's still entertainment.
Yeah.
If you put a real investigation on TV, it'd be as exciting as watching paint dry, and nobody would watch it.
Right.
But, you know, the good thing about these shows is that they do acquaint people with the fact that the stuff is out there, and it is more accessible than a lot of people think. Bad thing is that the evidence that gets shown is sometimes it's just outright fake, and sometimes it's heavily embellished to be more dramatic, which is natural for the medium. So that also skews people's perceptions and expectations. I mean, I've led ghost hunts where, you know, people will walk into a place and they want to see stuff happen. They want to see stuff fly across the room, the lights go on and off, you know, doors open and close. And then they get upset when it doesn't happen. They'll look at me and say, well, can't you make them do something? Well, no, I can't. You know, ghostly phenomena are not on demand. But that's what TV has taught many people to expect. So I think an important part of our educational efforts, we in the paranormal who are doing the real field research, we do need to tell people that, yes, the stuff is out there, but it's not quite what you see on the screen and on TV.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are some researchers who have researched for years and they've never seen anything move physically or something. And, you know, I like to think of, I tell people EVPs always, you know, record, because it seems to be one of the more abundant manifestations. And we played some that we had gotten at a before you came on the show, but you know, that's still very far and few between, and it means you have to sit there and listen to hours and hours of audio to get this split second, you know, EVP.
It is quite painstaking and tedious, and yes, I agree with you that EVP is one of the easiest kinds of evidence to get, and when people are starting out, you know, in the field, that's what I encourage them to try first. But, oh, man, the thousands of hours I have logged in doing vigils, videotaping, recording, and taking still photographs, and it's not uncommon to come up with nothing.
Yeah.
Or to take hundreds of photographs and then one that might be promising in terms of evidence or show something that can't be explained. So it's sometimes not glamorous at all. And, you know, you just can't waltz into a place and walk out with a pile of evidence.
Yeah. The great thing is, though, that with this sort of research, the common man, the layman, can do it because it's like a tape recorder, a camera. Some of the stuff, the basics, are not too expensive. You just have to be willing to, you know, like you said, don't think you can walk in and all of a sudden the room's going to go crazy like poltergeist. But if you're willing to put in the hours and the hours it takes, it can be fruitful and it can be, I think, you know, very satisfying.
It can, and also it's cascading because the more time that you put into this, your own consciousness changes in very dramatic yet subtle ways, and you begin tuning into these things. The more you tune into them, the more it feeds back to you. So my level of attainment of evidence has increased quite a bit over the years, even though it's still a far cry from what gets portrayed on TV. But that does, and that does happen to most researchers. It's exciting work because even if you have to put in a lot of time, collecting that single EVP or that photo or the video clip that defies explanation, it's paid. That makes everything worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And that point you made about equipment, yes, the lay person, so much available today that's relatively inexpensive. When I started in the 1980s, a ghost hunt was a film camera, a magnetic tape recorder, maybe a thermometer, a couple of other pieces of equipment if somebody access to them, and you sat in the dark and waved for things to happen. And now it's much different. You know, we can outfit ourselves quite well. And it is up to us, the lay people, because the scientists and the grant funding organizations don't jump into this. The TV shows get funded by the production companies, so they can go out and buy $30,000 thermal cams, you know.
Right.
And most of us, we can increase our technological sophistication, but not quite that much. But one thing I would like to say counter to that is I also caution people not to depend too much on equipment. And I kind of cringe a little bit when I hear groups say, oh, we're just scientific. We only use equipment. We don't use psychics, none of that stuff. And yet you're dealing with phenomena that are subjective. that are experienced by people psychically. If you are going to barge in with equipment and expect to get everything on equipment, you're missing 90% of the action. So I make use of psychics. I use my own psychic ability in investigations, and I think that's an important balance. You have to find a balance between the two. Psychics can give you the detail. You can get the hard evidence on equipment, but you don't get names, history, details, reasons, things like that, that psychics may be able to provide, which might then be validated by checking historical records.
Yeah, that was exciting. Before you came on, we talked about an investigation on a campus that my cousin had done and with a group. And what he did is he got the History Club to do research on all these areas they visited. Then they took psychics that were investigators to these areas, and they had a lot of hits. They had the psychics were able to come up with a lot of names and situations that the History Club was able to confirm, which was exciting because the History Club people were pretty amazed by that.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's a balance that we have to strike here in the investigations. And, of course, a lot of scientists are going to shudder if you say, well, we have to use psychics in investigation.
Yeah.
You know, what's eventually going to happen, Alejandro, I think, is we're going to forge a whole new, I'm going to call it scientific for lack of a better term. We're going to forge a whole new scientific approach to the paranormal that's going to blend the hard science with the subjective, and also, I believe, will incorporate some of our spiritual traditions, which have been interacting with these realms for a very long time.
Yeah, I think that's what... It's kind of a point we've come across where the subjective, which is, you know, some of what people think are kind of ritualistic type of things that, you know, older cultures or indigenous people still... get involved with that are based off of silly things, which has been the common belief. But we've also kind of caged ourselves in strict science where we just follow the numbers and we follow the data. But there's a huge gap in between where these experimental or experiential things are now sort of being validated by science, and some scientists are at least seeing that you don't need to throw out the experiential. I mean, that's part of science, technically, but unfortunately they throw it out so often. And you see this melding, like a lot of the quantum physicists, there's even an organization that is really into Buddhism, and they always have, luckily they're based out of Boulder, and they would bring the Dalai Lama into Denver and talk with them because they're finding that a lot of those experiential type of philosophies that were created are now kind of being validated and helping them in their science. And you're right. I think we're coming to this point where hopefully we'll be more accepting of both sides.
It's who knows how long it's going to take to actually gel, but we're in this process now. And I tell people who are, you know, newcomers to the field, you know, they want to jump in and start doing things, that they can play a very important role because the lay people have been the ones out in the forefront making the advancements in our understandings by getting out in the trenches.
Yep.
You know, one interesting thing about the scientists is when parapsychology started forming as a scientific approach to the paranormal, an outgrowth of psychical research from the late 1800s, to experiments in the laboratory, you know, can psychic phenomena be replicated, you know, that sort of thing. One of the first things that the researchers found was that consciousness affects results. There's the experimenter effect, where the attitude of the experimenter affects the outcome, and the sheep goat effect. Believers get better results than non-believers. So our intentions, our attitudes, literally influence what gets fed back to us from a psychic perspective. And again, that reinforces physics, that
mm-hmm.
we are not just observers. In fact, there's no such thing as a discrete observer. You're automatically part of whatever process you're trying to observe
yep.
and affecting what you observe.
That kind of punctuates a point you made earlier, which I really liked, which is kind of this attunement. The more that you investigate, the more you come attuned, and the more you are able to gather evidence.
It's very true. And when people ask my advice, you know, what should I do for starting out in the paranormal? Well, you know, the obvious things, read and study. I'm amazed mm-hmm. at people who want to go out and investigate right away without having
right.
a shred of knowledge about what they might encounter. How are you going to explain what you encounter if you haven't done any study? But the most important thing to me is establish a daily practice of meditation. And I've been doing that for years. The reason why is that changes your consciousness. And it also strengthens the natural buffer around you
mm-hmm.
so that you're not overwhelmed by what you encounter.
Yeah.
And I tell people, it doesn't matter what your spiritual or religious beliefs are.
Right.
Find that spiritual center and connect with it in meditation. And that's how you stay grounded. It's very important. And it also refines consciousness so that you have a better ability to engage with these things without being thrown off kilter by them.
Right. Yeah.
I also recommend to people that they get a little training in, oh, you can take classes in psychic or intuitive development. I found energy healing very, very useful. You don't have to hang a shingle out as a Reiki master. But taking entry-level energy healing teaches you how to open yourself up, experience something, validate it, interpret it correctly and validate it, and shut back down.
Yeah, interesting, because those are all things that I've done that for other reasons, but I later found out they did aid me in my investigation goals as well, especially with kind of massaging that boggle barrier or that fear barrier and increasing those. And I think, you know, people don't understand when you take a moment and listen to yourself and you get to understand your limitations and work with those things in meditation, that it's very fruitful. Very quickly you're able to expand your abilities in those areas just by simply sitting down and relaxing and meditating and for a short period of time a day or even every other or few days.
Even just a short period a day. I get very interested in Zen Buddhism many years ago, and I started doing Zen meditation. And I had experimented with some Eastern techniques before that. I caught into the Buddhist techniques. They just resonated with me. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I incorporated a lot of Zen practices into my meditation. And so the way I meditate now, it's kind of an amalgam of things that I've experienced and experimented with over the years. I think that's how it works for everyone.
Yes.
You sort of find what's best for you.
Yeah.
And I do believe that that's been a tremendous aid to me. The paranormal investigator of today, if we're going to be really effective in the field, we have to be well integrated on a lot of fronts.
Mm-hmm.
So, and here again, this is where things get a bit skewed off kilter with the reality shows. They make it look like all you have to do is, you know, arm yourself with as much gear as possible and go out to a haunted place, and you will get phenomena up one side and down the other. And then the big question is, well, what do you do with it? And
yeah.
here comes the term that I've been coining terms lately, Alejandro, and this is another one that I've been talking about a lot, hamster wheel ghost hunting. These shows encourage investigation that goes round and round in circles. Hey, dude, we got a ghost here, and it never goes anywhere else. We're
yes.
left with integration of the data, what do we do with this? Okay, we've got phenomena here. What is that telling us? What is that telling us about us, the cosmos, the multidimensional universe? Yes, it's exciting to go out and be haunted and experience a ghost. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with just having a thrill experience. We've all been there, including myself. But here again, if you're going to be an effective investigator, you've got to interpret and apply the data. And so I see a lot of this in the paranormal now with this wheel spinning, that we've got groups who have sprung up like mushrooms after rain who have the ability to go out and investigate, but they are lacking the experience or maybe even the desire to do something with the data that they've got other than try and get a reality show, which is what a lot of them are trying to do.
Right. I love that. I love this vocabulary because these are things like the hamster wheel ghost hunting. That's something that I have thought of a lot of and haven't been able to articulate in a term. Now I've got one. But I agree with you. You know, one of the things that frustrates me with these television shows is if they're so into science, why don't they bring a theoretical physicist with them or at least have one look at who's open to this stuff, like Philip, or like I know you're familiar with a friend of mine, Dr. Claude Swanson, who's a theoretical physicist who incorporates this in his physics, and he can put this in a framework which starts to mix with cosmology and everything else. To, like you said, take this to a level to where we can increase our understanding and not just have a neat picture of a ghost or some weird EVPs, but to do something more with it. And the television shows, I don't understand why they don't try to do that, because there are people who would be willing to look at their information or go with them on their ghost hunts.
I think we are going to get to that level. I think that's going to be like the next thing that really opens up for us. You know, Nat Geo, the National Geographic Channel, had a show on where they brought seasoned scientists together to investigate. And I don't know if this show is still on, but it was darn good.
Wow.
And much, much better than the reality shows.
Was that the lab or something like that?
No, I hope I'm not getting the name wrong, but it's something like American Ghost Hunters or American Ghost Hunting or something like that. The reality shows, and the thing is that the reality shows will sometimes ask people like me and Phil to be on. Mostly they want people who don't know anything, who will do or say anything, who are basically acting. And that's what we're seeing on TV is... there are some of the people who are leading these teams have never been involved in the paranormal. They know nothing about the paranormal, and mostly they don't even care. It's just entertainment. And I've been asked to be on shows, but I'm not going to follow a script. I don't like the idea of being on a show that's falsifying evidence. And so I prefer something that's either a recreated docudrama or a documentary. And I think we're going to see the audience for the paranormal begin to ask for these kinds of shows where we've all been entertained up one side and down the other, and I don't think that's ever going to go away. I think we'll still have the entertainment factor. But there will be people who will want to go deeper. And so and I'm hearing this on the grapevine, too, about things in development, that the next breed of paranormal programming out there is going to have more depth to it.
Well, I hope so. Luckily,
that's a good sign.
Yeah, in the entertainment world, things change constantly, and they always need to come up with something new. So I hope you're right. Now, I want to get into, before I forget, because I love these subjects and I love this vocabulary that I'm learning here, but I wanted to get into some of your work you talked about earlier, which I think is terribly interesting, and that is into the shadow people And this idea that you had come across a lot of ET experiencers who experienced shadow people. And when you say that, do you mean you found that there were a lot of abductees that had shadow people experiences?
Yes. Primarily abductees rather than people who have just varying degrees of contact experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led me into a whole area of why do some people have these invasive visitations by entities who want something from them? And do these people have something in their makeup that other entities are after? Are they simply easy targets because maybe they don't have very good boundaries, or a combination of things? There seem to me to be we're approached by entities who have agendas, and for the most part, I don't think they're very friendly agendas. I think they're probably very hostile to us, or at least detrimental to us. Certainly, the abduction scenario is not a pleasant one. And the thing with shadow people is they're not abducting us, although some people think that they have the fear that the entities want to do that, but they want to come and observe us when we're at our most vulnerable, which is when we're sleeping.
Hmm.
I got involved in shadow people, well, in a serious way, in late 2004. And of course, you know, I'd heard about shadow people and, you know, the dark ghosts and shadowy figures, of course, in haunted places and haunted homes. But sometimes my ongoing inquiries start with a flurry of emails. And I just started getting a lot of emails in a short period of time from people who described these shadow people experiences, and they wanted to know what was going on. So I thought, might investigate this a little more, maybe collect a few dozen experiences. And here I am, almost 6 years later, with hundreds of experiences in my database and an ever-expanding radar scope looking into this phenomenon. It reaches into almost every paranormal encounter that people report. The core experience is this shadowy figure who's a bedroom visitor who almost always looks like a man, 6 to 7 feet tall, usually dressed in something drapey like a coat or a cape or a cloak, and often wearing a hat, very out-of-fashion hat usually, Dick Tracy detective hats, Abraham Lincoln stovepipe hats, fedoras, Spanish fedoras. There's something going on with the disguise here. So they're solid black, no features, yet you feel stared at, and they radiate this malevolence. Sometimes when you wake up and you see them, they vanish. They look solid because they'll hide things behind them, but they will turn into a mist in an instant. They will go through walls, doors, back into closets, back under beds, simply disappear into thin air. Sometimes they attack people, but they are extremely frightening. And people use three words in almost every account that I've gotten: fear, panic, and terror.
Wow.
Some people are visited over and over by these things, and other people have maybe one or two experiences and no more. These are usually solitary figures. They don't come with a pack of ETs. Sometimes they come with what we call the little hooded beings with red eyes, 3 to 4 feet tall, nasty little pieces of work. But I found that the people who are regular shadow people experiencers, there was a significant overlap with the ET abduction experiencers. So there seem to be people out there who are targeted. And are these entities one and the same? Are they using different disguises? Are there collusions and cooperations and collaborations among different kinds of entities? Are the shadow people information gatherers that maybe they pass something on to the ETs? We simply don't know. I have come to the conclusion so far about shadow people. I went through a process of elimination. They clearly were not demonic to me, even though people feel they're very malevolent and evil. They're not human. They're not nightmare hag experiences, although sometimes people are not clear if they're awake or dreaming when they have the experiences. I don't think they're ETs. They look sort of like men in black, but they're not men in black. So I went through a process of elimination and wound up with, you know, here again, John Keel, ahead of his time, ultra-terrestrial, unknown entity living in another dimension. And then I began getting deeper into the jinn. And these are a separate race of entities who live in a parallel dimension. They're in our mythology. We know them as the genie in the bottle. But actually, they're much more than that, and they're shapeshifters. And they have a tradition in their folklore of being kicked out of our world to make way for us, and that some of them want it back. So there's a motive there. I do think, bottom line, that the shadow figure that we see is not the true form of whatever is visiting us. I think it's a disguise, and the hat may even cover up something that they can't completely disguise about what we would call the head area that might give away their identity. The jinn could certainly be shadow people. They could be a type of ET, but it's an entity that has a reason for wanting something from us.
Wow, interesting.
Experience.
When you say a shadow person attack, what is that like?
It blends combinations of the vampire, the nightmare hag, and occasionally the incubus succubus. I should say incubus, because rarely are these figures ever female. They don't very often exhibit a sexual interest in us, but I do have cases like that. What usually happens is they reach out, and sometimes their arms become like Gumby-like appendages. Now, we have the Gumby figures as part of the ET experience, too. Their arms will snake out, and they can grab people. They come down on people like a weight on the chest. They try and suffocate. I've had accounts from people wrestling with them and feeling like they had to call on every ounce of their physical strength and spiritual strength. You know, people are praying up one side and down the other. The vampire quality comes in with the breath. I have two different kinds of breath shadow people, and we find similar cases in vampire folklore. One is the breather, who kills you by breathing toxic breath on you. That's a vampire.
We've only got a few seconds.
Sorry?
We've only got a few seconds.
Oh, and the other is the breath sucker, and they suck your soul out. So it's a very intriguing phenomenon.
Interesting. Well, that is really interesting stuff. Your work is so fascinating. Of course, you can get all of your stuff on Amazon. Also, what is your website? Do you want to tell people that?
Visionaryliving.com. I have a free newsletter you can sign up for, and a library of articles that are excerpts from some of my books and independent pieces that I've written about my research.
All right, visionaryliving.com. If you have a chance, Rosemary does talks all over the place. You definitely want to catch one of her talks if you're available to. Thank you so much for being on the show, Rosemary.
Thank you, Alejandro, and happy seasonal Halloween to you.
Yes, happy Halloween. All right. Well, thank you for listening to Open Minds Radio once again. Join us next week. This has been Open Minds. We're your UFO news authority. And you have a good week, people.